Society of Superheroes is very proud to put on a special edition today. We missed the Sport for Development Day, but we are making sport front and center for today's edition. And today's podcast, we believe, needs to be an everyday discussion. It's something that really needs to not be celebrated on Child Protection Day or highlighted in the 16 Days of Activism. It's a conversation we as coaches and as parents need to be having with our children every day of the year. And we have brought with us Athletes Against Child Abuse to have the discussion with us, and they are dedicated to creating awareness and education in the safeguarding of children in the sports environment, providing a victim-centric advocacy platform for the fight for justice for children harmed in sport. Children should be free to participate in sport in a healthy, safe environment, free from discrimination, abuse, and sexual violence.
We welcome into studio Olivia Justreel and Debbie Wade, co-founders of Athletes Against Child Abuse. Olivia is a survivor, trailblazer, warrior, advocate for child rights, and sits on the SASCOC Safeguarding Committee. Having spent more than two-thirds of her life fighting for justice from an unremorseful, unrepentant child abuser, Olivia has made a commitment to every child athlete to seek justice for victims and campaign for no parole for sex offenders. Debbie is the latest addition to courageous women advocating for the protection of children in sport. She won the Midmar Mile, and her son is a performance athlete on the competitive swimming circuit. Debbie most recently appeared in the media as the co-founder of WAMAC's Athletes Against Child Abuse. Her last media appearance was when she opened a case of child sexual abuse that occurred within the competitive swimming community decades ago. The case is ongoing.
Right, so we were all there yesterday, so it's going to be quite a good discussion that we can follow on from. So the thing that I found really inspiring about the launch yesterday is we had an enormously diverse group of people stand up to prevent abuse. Because what seems to have happened in both of your cases is that there was no voice for children in the, not to give any of your ages away, of course, but anyway, in the 70s and 80s. And the whole aim of what you're attempting to do now, as I understand it, Debbie, is to give a voice to children that we don't repeat the patterns that you suffered.
Exactly. And I think it was a very proud moment for both of us. And what makes it so special is that we have both been victims of it. And to stand there on a personal level and to just see all these amazing people, sporting icons, federations, really take the time and effort and, you know, come out and stand up with us, and stand next to us and be prepared to take on the fight against that. It's hugely emotional, because I know from my perspective, the biggest thing is not to be heard. And yet this platform, all of a sudden we have a voice, and it's amazing. The voice is getting louder and louder and louder. And so we are getting our disciples, and everybody's, it feels like there's a groundswell coming together and people are just saying, you know, no more. And how amazing that, you know, hopefully our future generations of athletes and sports people and that will just be able to go and enjoy their sport and be excited about participating in sport. And it was such a healthy, you know, such a healthy environment in that, and we should really be able to give our children that, and really excited about this initiative and the amazing support that we've had. So, yeah.
So, Olivia, you're at the end of a process that Debbie is beginning, but it's a process with no end. It's a bit like that Doors song, this is the end, but it never sort of ends, you know. And the thing is that there's a level at which your competitive athletic spirit is actually quite a important skill to have in the system, because it's, I mean, your sport is tennis and competitive tennis, and it's always like the system is knocking the ball backward and forward. And some of them, they're smashing it at you, and others a bit of a drop shot because you don't see it. See, I tried to learn tennis terminology before the interview. But anyway, the idea that there is that fight in you as a competitive athlete, does that hold you in good stead once you enter the system? Because it is not an event entering the system, it's a process.
You know, Luke, I love your terminology, by the way. You seem to have got this. You know, Luke, for me, I think, you know, and I think for any victim, we have that fight within us. We do have that survival instinct within us. And we've got to really just dig really, really, really deep to for that to actually come out. So we all have it within us. And we need to get given a platform, which is hopefully what Athletes Against Child Abuse are doing. You know, for me personally, and I actually said this publicly, I actually thank Bob Hewitt for one of the lessons he taught me was you get every ball back, no matter what the price. And I remember him screaming and shouting at me and telling me, chase that ball down. And I chased that ball down. And yes, I have treated this like a tennis match. And every single ball that comes to me, I chase it down. And I do absolutely everything I can to get it back. And, you know, it has put me ahead a little bit. And yes, I think, you know, for athletes as well, like you say, we all have this inner fighting spirit. And it does hold us in good stead, with absolutely without a doubt.
The system is completely perpetrator-centric. It's not victim-centric at all. We don't look out for the people who suffered such abuse, and very often we spoke about being heard earlier. Those closest to us just don't want to listen. In terms of that, the role of Athletes Against Abuse, how are, and I say we, because I don't think it's just the job of Victims Against Abuse. I think it is the job of all of us to hold adults to account. So Debbie, in terms of the coaches and the systems in place or not in place to check if coaches have got police clearance or not on the child sex offenders list or not on it, rather, what are we going to do around that? Olivia, would you like to come in there?
You know, we have got a monumental job ahead of us in terms of the checking and that. So what I have established is that all the federations have to check their coaches. They have to run police clearances. That is what they are supposed to do. That is what they are telling parents, schools, that they are doing. But we know that they're not doing it, number one. And number two, the register is very far behind. So also speaking about abuse and for victims to come forward is a very, very new thing. So to get a person is not going to be on the sexual offences register, or it's not going to show up necessarily on their police clearances unless they've been convicted. So you might have a coach who is under investigation or who has committed a crime but only has charges against him. He's going to be checked, but he's not going to come up as an offender. So it's a huge, huge, huge problem. You know, and as far as vetting and everything goes, I think the only people that can really, really make this start working is when we stop sweeping it under the carpet, when the schools, the federations, and the parents stop ignoring it. We highlight the massive problem and we raise these issues. Then you know that X, Mr. Z, Mr. Y is a possible perpetrator. He needs to actually be watched. That's the problem we have behind us. What would really, really be nice is if we could implement a system, and it is one of our goals, is to accredit coaches. So, you know, can a federation come to us? Can a person in their private capacity contact us and say, has Mr. Z been through all the necessary checking, the necessary training? Do you actually accredit him as a coach? And maybe use that as a platform to support parents in making sure that they make a right decision when they send their child to a coach.
Now, and Debbie, I'd like to come in there because I know it's a very, very difficult topic, and I'm not attempting to blame anybody other than the coaches who abuse children. But one of the things we find over and over again is that parents, not all parents, certain parents, almost sacrifice their children to the sport. So it doesn't really matter what you have to go through. I'm not just talking about sexual abuse. The way that you are touched, handled, the level of physicality required of little children, the emotional stuff that goes with high levels of competition, the stress, the anxiety, all of those kinds of things, that there's almost an acceptance that there's a price to pay for being a competitive athlete. And for me, that's one of the real... picking up on what Olivia said at the end, that's one of the things we really need to challenge. I mean, we should be developing our children, not a sport.
Yeah, Luke, I couldn't agree with you more. I was one of those high performance athletes, and it's, you know, it's easy to speak from real experience again. Growing up in an environment where, you know, performance was everything, to the cost of myself, my family. I know that there was no safe space for me, and every time I just felt as though it was, you know, shut up and swim. And, you know, it's just not acceptable. It's not acceptable to sacrifice your children for, you know, for this. And what we also have to understand is that sport in a lot of ways is a way out. It's a way out of economic poverty. It's a way to a new life. Not only is it, you know, could it be the fantastic, you know, my child is the Olympic champion. It's a lot of parents are living their dreams through their children, vicariously through their children, that but also there's a real reality where we are facing economic economic poverty, and sport offers children a way out, offers communities a way out. And so, you know, parents, communities, the people that should be looking after children would sacrifice their very well-being for that better life, at the risk of the children. So where do those children go? There is nowhere safe to go. And you almost are raised with the understanding that it's okay. Mm-hmm. It is all okay, because that is the price you pay for the performance. In fact, as a child, you don't even know that you are paying that price. Mm-hmm. It is only when you are older, when you look back at that and you say, you know, I didn't even want to perform. You know, I was forced to perform. Mm. I was forced to do these things. It was not always my choice as such. So this culture of high performance at any cost is not okay. And I think that we need to get back to, you know, parents need to be involved with their children. Parents need to know what's going on in their children's lives. They cannot just relegate the responsibility of their children to, you know, to coaches, to schools, and stand back and say, well, you know, it's your responsibility. It is not. It starts at home. It starts with parents. It starts with siblings. It starts with the community in that. We have to look after our children. We've got to know what's going on in our children's lives. And our children's lives are much more important than a gold medal or any type of performance.
We've spoken a lot about listening, especially as parents, and being heard. And you speak about living vicariously through your children. My daughter had the potential to be a very good swimmer. And I remember taking her to a very good private school who had a fantastic swimming program, and I thrust her upon the head of sport and I said, this is Claudia and she's a fabulous swimmer, and hoping obviously to get a bursary because it would have helped financially a lot. And I remember her turning to the head of sport and saying, I'm not swimming. Do you have pottery? And he just looked at her as if to say, oh my goodness. And I think in that moment as a parent, it brought me really back to reality to say, well, this child actually doesn't want to swim, and that's okay. And it was a huge lesson for me in terms of listening actively to my child and not forcing her then to do something that actually didn't bring her joy.
Okay, so Olivia, your experience was a little bit different because you love tennis.
Yo, Luke, I have my moments where I did love tennis. It was actually all I knew,
to
be quite honest. And, you know, just to touch on something Debbie said now is that a parent will push us or live vicariously through us. Mm. You know, something that was said, and I'm going to raise this quickly now, is a lot of people do know that my parents testified against me for Bob Hewitt. That is the power and the level that man was at. And, you know, something my mom said in the courtroom when she was testifying, and it has stuck with me, but it only hit home then, that not just did he abuse me, she actually abused me as well, was that it was raised that I had broken an arm, and that I'd had to go back onto the tennis court 3 days after I'd broken my arm. And something my mom says, yes, she did go and play a tournament. She was expected to do that. And that only actually occurred to me during the trial, which was 6 years ago. I was 45 years old when I realized that I was actually abused all round. I've lost my train of thought now.
No, well, it's the train of thought's an oncoming train, so I'll redirect you. Because the one thing that you said to me that over the years that was for me quite something was that it was something, it may have been all you knew, but it was something that you really did enjoy. And the thing that for you was tragic was that this experience of abuse killed it for you. And the one thing you tried to get back on the court, what I think in your 48s, in your late 40s, where you try to somehow reclaim what had been taken from you to see, I don't know, what had been taken from you and almost to exert your power back to say, I should have chosen whether to progress in the sport or not, but it was almost chosen for you.
So, you know, Luke, as a little girl, so for my fifth birthday, I was given a tennis racket and a coach. I used to love ballet. And by my seventh birthday, I was made to choose between ballet or tennis. As a seven-year-old, how do you make that choice? Sure. Anyhow, I chose tennis. Did I love it? Yes, I did love it. But I think I more loved what came with being number one in the country, with being so ranked so well in the world, you know, with being always on the winning and always on the up, with being the first person, the youngest person ever in high school to receive full colors. You know, those kinds of things. So did I really love it? Yeah, I did. You know, I got a scholarship. I went overseas. I really, really excelled. I then gave up for 24 years. And after our court case, I actually decided I was going to prove a point. Did I get back on the court because I loved it? No, I got back on the court because I tried to prove a point. And within a year of being back on the tennis court, I was number 10 in the country. Within 2 years, I was number 5 in the country. So then I did love it. Then he got parole, and I hated it again. And I can't get back on the court now. It's very, very difficult for me.
And Debbie, you had a similar experience about your career being cut short, because, I mean, you were also a heavily competitive mid-mile mile winner.
More than just a mid-mile mile winner. I was a South African swimmer, an international swimmer in the sense that we were in the sanction era. Okay. Just wanted to make one point when you say, you ask a question, you know, you loved the sport. Mm. Well, it's quite difficult to answer that question because never been given the opportunity to understand if I loved the sport or if I hated it, because I knew that I was extremely good at it. I knew when I started I loved it. I was having fun. However, that all changed the day that I met this person, and all of a sudden that person becomes so intrinsically linked with the sport that you cannot ever, well, personally, I can't answer the question, did I love the sport? Because it's so intrinsically linked. You can never remove, I cannot remove the sport from the person and what happened in the sport.
Okay. So I think, you know, I think as we start wrapping up, I mean, I think that's a nice way to move forward, because the thing is, I was never a competitive sportsman. I don't like competing, believe it or not. I really am not competitive. Okay.
I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, I'm sitting here and sitting with gobsmacked thinking.
But I do really enjoy sport. You know, so I mean, when people used to compete, it was like, whatever, you know. So I think I had a very different experience of sport. And what we have done is use sport to develop young people. So as athletes against child abuse, for me there's two elements. The one is that we need to prevent abuse, we need to deal with high-risk situations, we need to manage the law, which is a complex thing, we need to care for people afterwards. But we also need to show the potential of sport. I mean, the last post before the launch, our post was a Bolivian or Colombian boxer. And the reason she boxed is because she was abused. And not abused in sport, but she used sport as a tool for healing. So if you could maybe just conclude with your thoughts on that, so that we are not seen as the people going out with the sledgehammers to hammer, you know, professional sport only. We're also seeing the benefit and the potential wonder that sport can bring, if chosen, to the lives of young people.
I really do believe this is the essence as to why we are doing what we are doing. Because I want to say that this stops with our generation. This stops with me. This stops with Olivia. Sport is such a fantastic, fantastic God-given right. It is a God-given blessing to be able to participate and just to be able to be free and see how fantastic you actually can be. Mm. And when I look at my beautiful son and I see him swimming and just how free and magnificent he is, mm, it brings home the absolute beauty of sport. And so the only reason that we are doing this is not about hammering people or going after them. It's about saying enough. Mm. This will never happen to, well, not never, but that is our pledge. Mm. We don't want this to continue to happen. We want our children and future children to walk into places of sport and to be able to enjoy sport in the pure essence of what it was meant and should always be.
Debbie, you touched earlier on, you know, economics, and we spoke about bursaries and what have you at schools. And what we see most especially is the schools, if they have bragging rights over athletes. So they'll say, oh, we've had X number of rugby players or tennis players and academics and what. And what I'd really like to see happening is that schools put out and say, Mr. X is our coach, and he is not on the child. You know, he's followed all of these protocols and procedures. We've been through it to vet him. So not only is he an exceptional coach, but we've done everything in our power to ensure that he is not an abuser. I know that's very difficult to do, but everything due diligence has been done to ensure that your children are safe with this person. And what my challenge is to schools, especially where we see coaches, these high performance schools, is that they are taking this very, very seriously. And instead of just having bragging rights, to say that our coaches have been through a very stringent vetting process.
Karen, may I just make 2 points? Number one, it is not he.
Oh, no, thank you. I do apologize. Yes. That was the wrong pronoun to use.
So we are very, very aware that this abuse happens everywhere. Mm. Number two, this is not bashing coaches either as such. We find that a coach could be anyone. It could be a mentor. It could be somebody who is, a working father who decides to help, or a working mom or whatever. So this is not about, it's not about that. It is also very difficult that, to say, well, we have vetted, because people can tick boxes. Mm. They can absolutely tick boxes, and you can go through all of those. We can put the systems in place. We can hopefully get those boxes in place. But what we need to be doing more than most is we need to be breaking the silence around this abuse. We need to change the culture. We need to encourage people to stand up and say no. If things are happening, speak out. Everybody collectively, don't hide it away. Don't cover it up. Don't pass the problem from one school to the next, because let's just protect our reputation and pass that problem on to somebody else. Let's just shine a light on it and do rather than tick boxes.
So important. Such important points. Thank you, Debbie.
All right. So, Olivia, your concluding message as one of the co-founders, what do you want people to hear about Athletes Against Child Abuse?
I think for me personally, one of the main things that Athletes Against Child Abuse wants to bring to the fore is we want to give that voice to children. So me as a victim, I never really had anywhere to go. The message we want to do is we want to encourage children and anybody that knows about abuse that could be happening. We want to encourage them to come forward. We want to encourage them to be brave and speak to us so that we can make it better for them and we can stop anything that needs to be stopped in its tracks.
So we move from warrior with an O to warrior with an A. Took a while, Olivia. Thank you very much, everybody. And we thank you for joining us on Society Superhero Special Edition, dealing with sport and the protection of children within sport. And we look forward to you tuning in again, and happy day.